Welcome, everyone, to our fourth session in our Lenten series based upon the grace of Les Miserables. In week one, we explored the character of Jean Valjean and the idea of grace. In week two, we were joined by our son Andrew, who delved into Inspector Javert and the idea of justice and when grace collides with justice. Last week, Jane, along with Anna Miller, explored the character of Fantine and the notion of poverty. This week, we're going to be led by my friend Bill Thurston and our chair of the Board of Deacons, who's going to delve into the characters of Marius and Cosette and the notion of love. Our son Andrew commented to me several days ago that this series has taken on a scope and an importance greater than any of us ever anticipated as our Lenten journey has merged with a journey for all of us through this pandemic. And really the two are not exclusive or dissimilar in their seriousness. And with that background, Bill, how did you and I begin to explore together this story of Les Mis?
Roy and I went in his pickup truck with three dogs to Kansas to hunt the elusive quail, all but one of which went home safe, by the way. As it was such a long drive, we talked about a lot of things, but we got into talking about this series, and Roy introduced me to the concept. And so I would look things up with my phone on the internet about articles about Les Mis, and we would talk about it. So we have had a lot of conversation. Great conversation about the subject, and we look forward to today.
Very good.
Les Miserables, translated literally, means the miserables. But what it really is referring to is the oppressed and the underclass. And when we get to talking about Marius and Cosette, the curtain really comes up on the bigger picture of what was going on in France at the time. It's the Second French Revolution, really. It follows the monarchy having been overthrown in 1789 and moving to the Republic and then to the Empire under Napoleon. And now there has been a restoration of the monarchy, and none of those changes seem to have helped the underclass become less oppressed. To me, watching the movie is like seeing a nightmare. And I think particularly of the sequence where Fantine is shown just having been fired from her job and is in this nighttime horrible situation of people with painted faces and dyed hair and absolutely no scruples, and she is completely victimized by everything that's going on. But that's probably true of the whole society at the time, at least the underclass of the society. There's the problem of Javert and Valjean. Javert just will not let go. Valjean begins as having been a thief and is transformed, and we'll talk more about that. There's the sequence I just mentioned about Fantine being overcome with the underclass. The Thénardier, who don't seem to have any scruples at all, are common thieves in running their inn, and the extreme uncertainty of the revolution. So all of this gives you that feeling that you have when you have a nightmare, that Things are completely out of control and are just rolling over you. So Marius appears, and he is young and a romantic, and he's passionate about things. He starts off because he was raised by his grandfather as a royalist. And I'd sort of like to ask you, Roy, to talk about that, because there's more detail in the book, which Roy has read and I have not, than there is in the movie. But to talk about Marius' background.
Certainly. Marius's father had served as a colonel under Napoleon, a highly decorated soldier, and at the Battle of Waterloo, on the battlefield, Napoleon named Marius's father a baron, gave him the title of a baron. But Marius's mother died young. He was raised not by his father, but by his grandfather, who cut him off from his father, forbid any conversation about the father. So because the grandfather had grown up under the Bourbon dynasty, under royalism, his grandfather was a bourgeois who was completely given to the royalists. And the father, having been a follower of Napoleon, a Bonapartist, the grandfather, that underlay the grandfather's forbidding of anything related to the father. Marius was raised as a royalist under his grandfather. Being a passionate young romantic, this being a romantic novel from the romantic period of literature, Marius was completely devoted to royalism until his dying father asked to see Marius. By the time Marius reached his father, the father had passed away, the colonel had passed away, but it left a brief note for Marius, which opened Marius's eyes to the love that his father had always had for him. The father used to actually, on Sunday mornings, sneak into the back of a church and hide behind a pillar to watch Marius sitting in a pew in a Sunday morning church service. That was the level of the father's love to Marius. So Marius threw away royalism. As a result, he had a break from his grandfather. He left penniless, basically, from the house of his grandfather, and became devoted to the memory and the beliefs of his father. He became, at this point, more of a Bonapartist in his leanings. Until later in our story today, he became all about love once he had encountered Cosette. And then finally, he becomes maybe not completely tied to republicanism, but nonetheless joins in with his friends at the barricades toward the end of the novel. Now, an interesting thing about Marius is the autobiographical element here to his story with that of Victor Hugo himself, Victor Hugo being the author of Les Mis. Victor Hugo's father was a general under Napoleon who went to serve for a period in Spain, Spain having been conquered by Napoleon. Hugo's mother was a royalist, however, and so she separated from Hugo's father. She came back to Paris, bringing Victor Hugo, the young Victor Hugo, with her. He was raised as a royalist. He was later reconciled with his father and developed Bonapartist leanings after that. I mean, you can see how the story of Marius and the story of Victor Hugo himself dovetail together. So Hugo was writing of his own background here.
Well, and not only of his own background, but probably of some of ours. Remembering back when we were young and the world was open to us, how we bounced maybe from one thing to another as our passions changed.
And by the way, Marius was, at the barricades, Marius was all of 22 years old. And so the impetuousness of youth, I mean, let's give him a break.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's a very sympathetic picture. And what Matt Rawl says about it is that God calls us all the time to move forward into an uncertain future. And I think we can all think of examples of that, how the best laid plans are upset, and you look back over your life and there are things there that you hadn't been in your plan originally, and that's because the future is uncertain and we don't have control like we might like to. But he also says there's a time between going into the wilderness and the time when you understand why you are there. And I thought that was a great question that affects us today. We are going into something of a wilderness with not being together for this, for example, where we have to have social distancing and don't have group meetings and can't have worship services the way that we have before. And so we have this uncertainty about the future, and we still wonder why we're in the wilderness and what we do about it. But that time when you decide what to do about it seems to me came to Marius on the barricades when they were told that the people of Paris had not risen in revolution like they had counted on. And you'll remember in the movie how they all sort of became quiet and looked at each other on the barricade. And then little Gavroche starts their revolutionary anthem. And one by one they join in, and by the time they remember where they are and who they are and why they're on the barricade, and they are re-energized for it. Have you ever had the experience when everything seems to be turned upside down? And I'm sure we could look at today and say that, but that's what these folks were facing at the time. Everything was uncertain. There didn't seem to be any common morality among all the people that the characters in the movie are faced with. And so that's a huge time of huge uncertainty. I remember for me, and you probably remember the same thing, in the 60s, mid to late 60s, when it seemed like the world was just coming apart. There was the civil rights protests and pictures of police with dogs and water cannons driving African Americans from the street. There were the assassinations, John Kennedy in 63, and then Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King in 68, and it just seemed like things were coming apart.
And Vietnam, and Kent State.
Kent State, the picture of the boy who'd been shot and killed and was lying on the street, and a girl's kneeling over him and screaming. Those are iconic kind of pictures that we have. And everything, I remember thinking, I was in my late teens, early 20s, I remember feeling like the world was coming apart, and why, and where is it going, and where do I fit in it? Sort of like standing on the deck of a wildly pitching boat, which I have experienced, trying to get a sail down. And there's no steady point. There's the deck is heaving, and you have to have one hand for yourself and one hand for the whatever you're trying to do. And it's that kind of feeling. And I think that's what is evoked by the movie. We'll talk more about the kind of wilderness that we're in now in a few minutes. But to go on to Cosette, what is striking, I think, about her when she is first introduced with the Thénardiers in the movie, and she is treated as little better than a scullery maid, And yet she dreams, and she has the doll that she holds, and she can dream of a soft lady and soft cloth and so forth. And it's just amazing to me how resilient children can be that way. The Thénardiers are unworthy of anybody's trust, and so of course she doesn't trust them. Earlier in the movie and in the novel, Valjean is hardly worthy of anybody's trust. The bishop trusted him, but Valjean ran off with his silver, all but the candlesticks. And then because of his transformation, when he and Cosette are escaping in the carriage at night, you may remember that she is asleep on his lap, and he is singing. And one of the lines in there shows his amazement that she trusts me. And that's, we talked before about the transformation of Valjean being something that goes on throughout his life.
Right. In the movie, necessarily, Jean Valjean's transformation, his conversion experience, is pretty much instantaneous. He goes from criminal to good man.
Yeah.
But in the novel, there is opportunity, much opportunity, to develop him over a long period of time. And his journey in the novel really goes from beginning to end. And he has stages in that journey, distinctive stages. And Matt Rawl talks about it a little bit in the video for that first session. But from the bishop, Jean Valjean received grace. He learned about grace. And he began to then give grace, acts of grace, sharing money and founding a hospital and things like that. Excuse me, but then there was and the novel talks about it a little bit, there was a tendency, a risk of Jean Valjean becoming self-satisfied. He'd gone to Montreux, he'd built up this factory, textile factory. He had become a wealthy man. He was generous to others. Others had come to rely upon him to the extent that they made him the mayor of the town. He could have become a bit self-satisfied and a bit egotistic. And then he ran into Fantine. And from that experience, he learned humility. And that humility stayed with him for the rest of his life. But then with Cosette, he learned love. And the novel makes very clear that Cosette was the only person that he had ever loved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and also, I thought the segment on his journey as Le Maire was very interesting in that Javert shows up. And it turns out that Javert turned in a report of Valjean as being someone who was not carrying his papers, and he was a fraud as this wealthy person, and that someone else had been arrested and charged with being Javert and was in danger of spending the rest of his life as a prisoner. And it was just powerful the way that Valjean wrestled with the two sides of the question whether he ought to turn himself in. Because on the one side, if he didn't turn himself in, the good thing about it was that he could continue to care for a number of people. The bad thing about it was that an innocent man would go into prison instead of him. And so he had to wrestle with that, and he comes out with the grace-filled, to me, idea that he needs to go save the person who's charged in his place, and he does that.
And we talked about it in this somewhat in the first session. Yes, he wrestled, but the whole time he was in conflict, he was traveling toward the town, the other town where the trial was going to be held, and going to great effort to get there on time to be able to save this man. So yeah, he was wrestling as he was making his way. So his path was pretty clear in reality. The other thing is, why did he reach this decision that he did? And what I postulated in session one was that if he came forward and he saved this other man, who really was a clueless character in the novel, well, first of all, if he chose not to do that, if he chose not to go and testify, and the man, as a result of which Jean Valjean was able to continue on as mayor, as the owner of the factory, as the benefactor of his town and region, if he was denied that, if Javert came and denied him of that because he testified, that was on society, that was on justice. But if he didn't go and testify, if he didn't save this man, that was going to be on him.
Yeah, yeah.
And so ultimately, he had to decide to do the thing that reflected on his character and his morality.
Well, and I think that's really important relating to Cosette then, because Valjean has been given through grace this trust that the bishop has given him, and saying he has bought his soul for God, and that is then reflected later on in other scenes in his life, one of which is rescuing Cosette and protecting her as she grows up.
And he felt guilt because he was not able to save Fantine. It was too late. Once he understood the wrong that had been done to Fantine under his care, because it was from his factory that she was fired without his knowledge. The movie implies that he had knowledge. The book makes clear that he did not.
Okay.
Had no idea about Fantine's existence as an employee. But once he did find out in the novel, he in essence made a promise to her on her deathbed in the hospital that he would save her daughter, and he did.
And that's so helpful to have somebody here who's read the book, because that is no small feat, a 1,400 page paperback book. And so there, Roy has a lot more detail about the development of the characters and so forth. But we are given in the movie a good taste of who the man has become and who he is when he takes Cosette under his protection. And that follows while she is growing up. She lives in a very protected way in a convent with him, and so she is not out there mingling in the community, as I understand.
Correct. Javert is nearby. Javert is in pursuit. But once again, resourceful Jean Valjean is able to escape. He's got Cosette with him, and he is able to climb the wall. He didn't know where the wall was leading him, what was on the other side of the wall, but he was able to climb this wall. And with a rope he had found, he was able to then raise Cosette up, lower her on the other side of the wall, and drop down, and found himself in a convent. A very sequestered convent, where nobody from the outside world literally was allowed in.
And he's face to face with the gardener, who is the person that he saved in the street when a cart collapsed.
Correct.
On him.
So that man who had been under the cart had gone, traveled, and become the gardener for this convent. He was the only male allowed in there, and what happened, Jean Valjean was passed off as the brother of this gardener. My brother has arrived, because the man has gratitude to Jean Valjean, and this man has been given grace, and he gives grace in return to shelter Jean Valjean and Cosette. And Jean Valjean is permitted to become the assistant gardener, and Cosette is brought into the school run by the nuns. That's how Cosette received her education in that convent school. By the way, one of the things that motivated the nuns to bring her in, the Mother Superior, I guess that's the right term, in particular was Cosette was not very attractive. And they thought she would grow up homely and therefore more likely to join the order.
That's helpful.
But nonetheless, they lived there in a sheltered way. When Cosette began to grow up and wanted to see more of the outside world, Jean Valjean and Cosette left the convent and lived in a secluded way within Greater Paris. And Cosette very definitely continued to live within a cocoon where she interacted very little with others, but was cared for completely by Jean Valjean.
So with this whole complex situation, Cosette having been, grown up the way that she did in that protected atmosphere, and Marius being swept up in revolution, they see each other and immediately fall in love.
Cosette no longer being homely.
No, but, disappointment to the nuns, no
yeah,
doubt.
But having blossomed into this beautiful young woman. Mm-hmm. Marius, of course, is a handsome young man. And the two of them saw each other in the Luxembourg Gardens in Paris, and they fell in love with each other before they'd ever spoken a word, before they ever knew each other's names. They had fallen in love.
And what is there about that that's rational? None of it. None of it is the falling in love, the love at first sight idea is just completely irrational and the exact opposite end of the arranged marriage. Just something that is purely serendipity. What do we think about love at first sight these days? We think it's kind of frivolous, right? An infatuation, puppy love, we've got all kinds of names for it. So why is it in the story? Les Mis, why is, and it's toward the end of the novel, right?
Well, I mean, their love happens a little bit earlier, but in terms of their love progressing and them actually getting together, you're moving toward the end of the novel.
And so Hugo is trying to say something there, that amid this nightmarish existence, love can still blossom.
Yes.
Not with rationality, not with planning, but love can still happen. And it's maybe it's driven by the very fact of the uncertainty of the times. We've heard stories about people meeting, people that we've known meeting each other before World War II or during the war and falling in love and immediately getting married before he is sent off to war. And that doesn't make sense, but it is love. And what I think it is instead of dismissing it as fairy tale kind of stuff, is to think about it in the sense of hope. How could that possibly happen without hope? And I think that's what Victor Hugo is getting at.
Right. And by the way, I'm aware of a wedding that happened last weekend. And the big celebration, the crowd, the party, none of that was able to happen because of the pandemic. But the couple wanted to go ahead and be married and have the party later. And so that's what transpired. But when you think about it, that young couple wanted to face the times that we're in right now together as a married couple, committed to one another.
Right.
And it's very similar to what happened with Marius and Cosette.
Yeah. And I think it's a something that's common to the human condition. Mm-hmm. The idea of marriage and the commitment to each other and joining forces, so to speak, joining hearts, it is like having children. People continue to have children even in the worst of times. And it's because of hope for the future. Matt talks about, he talks about the difference between passions and rationality. This sort of love that we're talking about inflames the passions and makes life worth living. It has us see things beyond ourselves. It carries hope when all surrounding experience says there is no hope. And then he mentions Kierkegaard, who says, passion inflames and sagacity cools. And that's part of probably all of our lives. He says, neither this heat nor this cold, nor the combination of these two, is the pure air of the eternal. And so I would suggest that perhaps the fire of youthful passion and the restraint of mature wisdom are fine in their place, but the pure air of the eternal is transformative, as it was with Jean Valjean, and as it is with Cosette and Marius. There is the inflamed passion and the sagacity, the wisdom that maybe is set to one side, but what really is working there is the pure air of the eternal. And that is what we think of as being hope.
If I could share a few more thoughts based upon the reading of the novel and obviously being called upon to think a whole lot about this story. And just so you know, Bill and I have tried a lot of ideas out about the story on one another as we made that drive across the prairie, to and from across the prairie. In terms of character development, I mean, we do see a lot about Marius through the novel. There's not much character development with regard to Cosette. Interestingly, there's a lot more character development of Eponine compared to Cosette.
Who's the daughter of the Thénardiers.
And Gavroche, who is the son of the Thénardiers. So,
who are miserable people.
They are atrocious criminals. it is who the Thénardiers are. They try to get by through life by creating criminal acts against others. That's how they live. And yet their children rise above that in rags, barefoot. And yet they rise above it to display elements of character and elements of grace.
Why do you suppose Hugo used those two that way instead of just introducing some strangers to the story?
Because we have seen their condition and we know them to be among the miserables, is my theory.
Mm-hmm.
And they rise above being the miserables. They still have the rags, they still have the poverty, but they rise above their state to begin to show grace. And when I say that they showed grace, Eponine gave her life to save Marius. She stepped in front of a gun, basically, or she grabbed the barrel and pulled it to her, is what she did,
mm-hmm.
To save Marius. And Gavroche, he was killed when he was collecting bullets from the dead French soldiers in front of the barricades to bring back to the Republicans. He was killed. So in committing acts for the benefit of others, they sacrificed themselves. Those were their acts of grace.
Also, and evidence of transformation too, maybe.
Very definitely.
and again, a theme of hope.
Yeah.
Even though they die, they are not condemned to be their parents.
I agree. I think that's exactly right. You also see grace very definitely with Marius and Cosette. For Cosette, it's obvious. I mean, she starts out living under the Thénardiers. I mean, she's worse than a peasant. She's a slave in how she is treated.
Right.
And but on Christmas Eve, in the night, in the dark, some guest in the inn asked for water for his horse. And Cosette is sent out barefoot in the snow in the cold of Christmas Eve to fetch water from a distant spring. And that's where she meets Jean Valjean. You know, she encounters this stranger who says, "Don't be afraid, let me carry the bucket for you. What's your name?" Cosette. And he realizes he's found Fantine's daughter.
Yeah.
And the grace begins there. He carries the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
He pays 1,500 francs to free her from the Thénardiers. He buys her a doll. He raises her from that point on. So, you know, the grace is certainly self-evident. For Marius also, there is grace. Raised by his grandfather, a bourgeois. So he's raised in comfort. You know, after he is wounded, severely wounded at the barricades, and he is saved by Jean Valjean, who carries him through the sewers of Paris to rescue him. So that's, there is grace from Jean Valjean. He is brought to the home of his grandfather by Jean Valjean and left with his grandfather, who cares for him, and where Marius recovers and is reconciled with the grandfather. And the grandfather takes him back into the fold, you know. So, by the way, Marius is always a somewhat noble character. He, when he breaks with his grandfather following the death of his father, the colonel, when he breaks with his grandfather, he leaves with very little in his pocket. And you know, the clothes on his back and a few francs, basically. And makes his way in the world really among the peasants. I mean, he lives extremely humbly, but yet he always remains noble. You know, his head's always in the books and in the clouds, basically, as a true romantic should. You know, but that's his character, and then he experiences the acts of grace, you know, that I've already indicated. My feeling about Marius and Cosette. I mean, yes, Marius has swung, his pendulum has swung between various obsessions up to the point of the ripe old age of 22. And yet, once he gets to the barricades and he participates in that act of republicanism, which was important to Victor Hugo,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's also demonstrating leadership. I mean, at one point, after Marius almost single-handedly repulses an attack on the barricade, the first attack on the barricades, with a keg of gunpowder is how he did it. You know, leave now or I'll blow us all up. And so the troops withdrew, and Marius asks, "Who's the leader?" And I can't pronounce the name correctly, but Enrolas, however you know, the proper pronunciation, whatever it would be, says, "You are." You know, he demonstrates leadership, mm-hmm. and he shows bravery without yet being completely committed to what his beliefs were going to settle into. You know, so he's lived his whole life preparing for that moment, and there's a purity about him. And an ability about him. Cosette, grown up, raised by Jean Valjean, within the grace of Jean Valjean, within the care of nuns, and then amongst gardens and flowers and all of that. And she likewise is pure. maybe we don't know a lot about her, but she's pure. She, you know, and so the two of them come together. And maybe love is a bit irrational, but it's real. It happens. It happens in the world today. Mm-hmm. And so you have this merger of two pure individuals into a pure couple who have both received all of this grace. Mm-hmm. And so they are prepared to then lead forward without being beholden to anything of the past. You know, they're not beholden to royalists. They're not beholden to Napoleon. They're not, you know, they've shaken free from all those ties, and they're ready to carry their love into the future. And there, I think, lies the hope that Victor Hugo is trying to share.
Yeah, I agree. And a lot of that development must happen in the book.
It does. And that's why I'm talking so long, frankly, is to try to get that out.
Yeah, the movies essentially has to be more superficial in the development of those themes. But at the same time, it does show the passion of the love they have for each other. And it is treated in the way that it is going to develop. It's like the sapling that's going to develop into a great tree. And you still get the feeling it's a beginning of something very solid, and not just an infatuation. And that's the hope that you're talking about.
Right.
And hope comes through grace. And all of the kind of instances of grace that we've been talking about have led to that, and not only lead to the passion, but then by extension to the solidity and wisdom of something long term.
And what is grace but love?
Unmerited love. And these two had unmerited love for each other. They just saw each other, and it was love at first sight. And it's not something that's earned, that we can earn. So that says a lot about Lent. And we should talk about that. What does Les Mis have to do with Lent? Why do we do this series now? And I think it is in the uncertain times. Think back to Jesus' lifetime and the period of 40 days leading up to the crucifixion, and how everything seemed to be so wrong, so upside down. Rome was firmly in charge. Israel was firmly oppressed. And there didn't seem to be hope anywhere there. And then particularly you get to the crucifixion and Jesus saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? And there's the absolute bottom. I mean, that's sort of the bottom of history. Why have you forsaken me? And then, as it turns out, God had not forsaken him, because then Easter happens. And so to me, the Les Mis, as much as I know about it, not having read the book, is that kind of story that gets us thinking in terms of our own lives and our own society. We think today, and this wasn't on anybody's mind when this series was thought of, we think of today and the pandemic and how that has changed our lives just in the last 10 days, 2 weeks, and is likely to continue with that change. We're not lost. We have the grace of God that we look to, that we trust in, and therefore we have hope.
If you go to Scripture, and I mean, you've done seminary classes, and I haven't. You know, my study is more undergraduate than a seminary program. But If you go to Scripture, we've already talked about, I know in the Jean Valjean session, about the Ephesians passage with respect to grace. You know, that God gives grace, unmerited grace. Okay. But then you go otherwise into the New Testament. John 3:16 is referenced by Matt Rawl for this session. For God so loved the world. You know, right. And you go to 1 Corinthians 13, right. And the greatest of these is love.
Well, and you know, we think of that list of things in 1 Corinthians 13 as being love person to person. And until now, I have not thought of it as being God's love for us.
Yeah.
But it is not proud, it is sacrificial, it is all the things that are in.
Well, as Christians, we receive that love and we pass it on, just like we receive grace and pass it on.
Right.
You know, and it includes romantic love, but it includes love for our fellow man. It includes calling one another during this time when we can't be together and checking on one another and, you know, or texting or emailing or whatever we're doing to check in on one another. All of that is part of grace and part of love. But those two things are very much part of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And if we all remember that and act on that, there lies the hope, I think.
Well, and acting on it is so important for right now, and that's what we should be encouraging all of us to do, is set yourself a goal. I'm going to call three people that I haven't talked to each day, and just check on them, ask how they're doing, and whether there's anything they need or they're worried about or whatever, and that would be extending grace. And it is said that we love because He first loved us.
Exactly. We reflect it and we pass it on.
Yep. It's like a beautiful moonlit night. The moon isn't the light, but it reflects the light.
Or, yeah, how about the moon and the stars in Kansas? You want to talk about that?
Oh, man. We were out in the middle of nowhere, and it was something that I had been looking forward to about this trip, was being able to look up on a starry night and see millions and millions of stars, and it was true. It's the first time that I've seen the Milky Way in a long time.
Yeah.
Then I saw it again in Panama.
Okay.
Saw the Milky Way again. Excellent. Twice in one year.
All right. Well, are we done here?
I think we are.
All right. Very good. So, folks, thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening in on our discussion.